He stood in the doorway a few seconds, taking a good look around to make sure there was nobody in the restaurant who might make trouble for him if we were seen together after the row I made in the bank. Then he came over to the booth in the corner where I was sitting, slid in across from me and said, "It's still in the bank. Most of it, anyway. Just over $3,000. "Thank God," I said. "Well," he says, "that's the good part. The bad part is that the new account is in his name only." "Of course it is," I said. "He sure didn't give me no new passbook account card to sign. That would have tipped me off to his little game, wouldn't it?" "Many women wouldn't know one way or the other," he says. He cleared his throat, gave a yank on his tie, then looked around quick to see who'd come in when the bell over the door jingled. "Many women sign anything their husbands put in front of them." "Well, I ain't many women," I says. "I've noticed," he says back, kind of dry. "Anyway, I've done what you asked, and now I really have to get back to the bank. I wish I had time to drink a coffee with you." "You know," I says, "I kind of doubt that." "Actually, so do I," he says back. But he gave me his hand to shake, just like I was another man, and I took that as a bit of a compliment. I sat where I was until he was gone, and when the girl came back and asked me if I wanted a fresh cup of coffee, I told her no thanks. I had the acid indigestion from the first one. I had acid indigestion all right, but it wasn't the coffee that gave it to me. A person can always find something to be grateful for, no matter how dark things get. And going back on the ferry, I was grateful that at least I hadn't packed nothing. This way I didn't have all that work to undo again. I was glad I hadn't told Selena either. I'd set out to, but in the end I was afraid the secret might be too much for her, and she'd tell one of her friends and word might get back to Joe that way. It had even crossed my mind that she might get stubborn and say she didn't want to go. I didn't think that was likely, not the way she flinched back from Joe whenever he came close to her. But when it's a teenage girl you're dealing with, anything's possible, anything at all. So I had a few blessings to count, but no ideas. I couldn't very well take the money out of the joint savings account me and Joe had. There was about $46 in it. And our checking account was an even bigger laugh. If we weren't overdrawn, we were damn close. I wasn't going to just grab the kids up and go off, though. No, sir, and no, ma'am. If I did that, Joe would spend the money just for spite. I knew that as well as I knew my own name. He'd already managed to get through over $300 of it, according to Mr. Pease. And of the $3,000 left, I'd put at least $2,500 away myself. I earned it, scrubbing floors and washing windows and hanging out that damn bitch Vera Donovan's sheets. 6 pins, not just 4. All summer long. It wasn't as bad then as it turned out to be in the wintertime, but it still wasn't no day in the park, not by a long shot. Me and the kids were still gonna go. My mind was made up on that score. But I was damned if we was gonna go broke. I meant my children to have their money. Going back to the island, standing on the foredeck of the Island Princess with a fresh open-water wind cutting itself in two on my face and blowing my hair back from my temples, I knew I was going to get that money out of him again. The only thing I didn't know was how. Life went on. If you only looked at the top of things, it didn't look like anything had changed. Things never do seem to change much on the island. If you only look at the top of things, that is. But there's lots more to a life than what a body can see on top. And for me, at least, the things underneath seemed completely different that fall. The way I saw things had changed. And I suppose that was the biggest part of it. I'm not just talking about that third eye now. By the time little Pete's paper spooks had been taken down and his little pictures of turkeys and pilgrims had gone up, I was seeing all I needed to with my two good natural eyes. The greedy piggy way Joe'd watch Selena sometimes when she was in her robe, for instance, or how he'd look at her butt if she bent over to get a dishcloth out from under the sink. the way she'd swing wide of him when he was in his chair and she was crossing the living room to get to her room. How she'd try to make sure her hand never touched his when she passed him a dish at the supper table. It made my heart ache for shame and pity, but it also made me so mad that I went around most days feeling sick to my stomach. He was her father, for Christ's sake. His blood was running in her veins. She had his black Irish hair and double-jointed little fingers. But his eyes'd get all big and round if she was wearing a sleeveless blouse and her bra strap so much as fell down the side of her arm. I seen the way Joe Jr. also swung wide of him and wouldn't answer what Joe asked him if he could get away without doing it, and answered in a mutter when he couldn't. I remember the day Joe Jr. brought me his report on President Roosevelt when he got it back from the teacher. She'd marked it A+, and wrote on the front that it was the only A+ she'd given a history paper in 20 years of teaching, and she thought it might be good enough to get published in a newspaper. I asked Joe Jr. if he'd like to try sending it to the Ellsworth American, or maybe the Bar Harbor Times. I said I'd be glad to pay for the postage. He just shook his head and laughed. It wasn't a laugh I liked much. It was hard and cynical, like his father's. "And have him on my back for the next 6 months?" he asked. "No, thanks. Haven't you ever heard Dad call him Franklin D. Sheenyvelt?" I can see him now, Andy, only 12, but already pert near 6 feet tall, standing on the back porch, with his hands stuffed down deep in his pockets, looking at me as I held his report with the A+ on it. I remember the little tiny smile on the corners of his mouth. There was no goodwill in that smile, no good humor, no happiness. It was his father's smile, although I could never have told the boy that. "Of all the presidents, Dad hates Roosevelt the most," he told me. "That's why I picked him to do my report on. Now give it back, please. I'm going to burn it in the wood stove." "No, you ain't, Sonny Jim," I says. "And if you want to see what it feels like to be knocked over the porch rail and into the dooryard by your own mom, you just try to get it away from me." He shrugged. He'd done that like Joe, too. But his smile got wide, and it was sweeter than any his father ever wore in his life when it did that. "Okay," he said. "Just don't let him see it, okay?" I said I wouldn't, and he run off to shoot baskets with his friend Marky Giggory. I watched him go, holding his report and thinking about what had just passed between us. Mostly what I thought about was how he'd gotten his teacher's only A+ in 20 years, and how he'd done it by picking the president his father hated the most to make his report on. Then there was little Pete, always swaggering around with his butt switching and his lower lip pooched out, calling people sheenies and being kept after school 3 afternoons out of every 5 for getting in trouble. Once I had to go get him because he'd been fighting and hit some other little boy on the side of the head so hard he made his ear bleed. What his father said about it that night was, "I guess he'll know to get out of your way the next time he sees you coming, won't he, Petey?" I saw the way the boy's eyes lit up when Joe said that, and I saw how tenderly Joe carried him to bed an hour or so later. That fall, it seemed like I could see everything but the one thing I wanted to see most, a way to get clear of him. You know who finally gave me the answer? Vera. That's right, Vera Donovan herself. She was the only one who ever knew what I did, at least up until now, and she was the one who gave me the idea. All through the 50s, the Donovans were the summer people of all summer people. They showed up Memorial Day weekend, never left the island all summer long, and went back to Baltimore on Labor Day weekend. I don't know as you could set your watch by them, but I know damn well you could set your calendar by them. I'd take a cleaning crew in there the Wednesday after they left and swamp the place out from stem to stern, stripping beds, covering furniture, picking up the kids' toys and stacking the jigsaw puzzles down in the basement. I believe that by 1960, when the mister died, there must have been over 300 of those puzzles down there, stacked up between pieces of cardboard and growing mildew. I could do a complete cleaning like that because I knew that the chances were good no one would step foot into that house again until Memorial Day weekend next year. There were a few exceptions, of course. The year that little Pete was born, they come up and had their Thanksgiving on the island. The place was fully winterized, which we thought was funny. But, of course, summer people mostly are funny. And a year or two later, they come up for Christmas. I remember the Donovan kids took Selena and Joe Jr. sledding with them Christmas afternoon. And how Selena come home from 3 hours on Sunrise Hill with her cheeks as red as apples and her eyes sparkling like diamonds. She couldn't have been no more than 8 or 9 then, but I'm pretty sure she had a crush the size of a pickup truck on Donald Donovan, just the same. So they took Thanksgiving on the island 1 year, and Christmas on it another. But that was all. They were summer people. Or at least 3 out of 4 of them were. Vera was the fourth. She was from away, but in the end she turned out to be as much an island woman as I am, maybe more. In 1961, things started out just as they had all those other years, even though her husband had died in that car crash the year before. She and the kids showed up on Memorial Day, and Vera went to work doing jigsaw puzzles, collecting shells, smoking cigarettes, and having her special Vera Donovan brand of cocktail hour, which started at 5 and finished around 9:30. But it wasn't the same. Even I could see that. And I was only the hired help. The kids were drawn in and quiet, still mourning their dad, I guess. And not long after the 4th of July, the three of them had a real wowser of an argument while they were eating at the harbor side. I remember Jimmy DeWitt, who waited table there back then, saying he thought it had something to do with the car. Whatever it was, the kids left the next day. The hunky took them across to the mainland in the big motorboat they had, and I imagine some other hired hand grabbed onto them there. I ain't seen neither one of them since. Vera stayed. You could see she wasn't happy, but she stayed. That was a bad summer to be around her. She must have fired 6 temporary girls before Labor Day finally came. And when I seen the princess leaving the dock with her on it, I thought, I bet we don't see her next summer, or not for as long. She'll mend her fences with her kids. She'll have to. They're all she's got now. And if they're sick of little Tall, she'll bend to them and go somewheres else. After all, it's coming to be their time now, and she'll have to recognize that. Which only shows you how little I knew Vera Donovan back then. As far as that kitty was concerned, she didn't have to recognize Jack shit on a hill of beans if she didn't want to. She showed up on the ferry Memorial Day afternoon in 1962 by herself and stayed right through until Labor Day. She came by herself. She hadn't a good word for me or anybody else. She was drinking more than ever and looked like death's grandma most days. But she came and she stayed and she did her jigsaw puzzles and she went down all by herself now and collected her shells on the beach just like she always had. Once she told me that she believed Donald and Helga would be spending August at Pinewood, which is what they always called the house. You probably know that, Andy, but I doubt if Nancy does. But they never showed up. It was during 1962 that she started coming up after Labor Day. She called in mid-October and asked me to open the house, which I did. She stayed 3 days. The hunky come with her and stayed in the apartment over the garage, then left again. Before she did, she called me on the phone and told me to have Dougie Tappet check the furnace and to leave the dust sheets off the furniture. You'll be seeing a lot more of me now that my husband's affairs are finally settled, she says. Perhaps more of me than you like, Dolores. And I hope you'll be seeing the children, too. But I heard something in her voice that made me think she knew that part was wishful thinking, even back then. She come up the next time near the end of November, about a week after Thanksgiving, and she called right away, wanting me to vacuum the downstairs and change the bed linen upstairs. The sheets already on the beds were perfectly clean, of course, but clean wasn't enough for Mrs. Vera Kiss My Back Cheeks Donovan. Not nearly enough. She said they smelled musty, and she had no intention of sleeping in musty sheets, or letting her kids sleep in them. They were in boarding school, but she said they might decide at the last minute to spend the weekend with her instead of staying where they were. She probably knew better, but Vera was a Boy Scout at heart, believed in being prepared, she did. I was able to come right away, that being a slack time on the island for folks in my line of work. I trudged up there in a cold rain with my head down and my mind fuming away like it always did in the days after I found out what had happened to the kids' money. My trip to the bank had been almost a whole month before, and it had been eating away at me ever since, the way battery acid will eat a hole in your clothes or your skin if you get some on you. I couldn't eat a decent meal, couldn't sleep more than 3 hours at a stretch before some nightmare woke me up, couldn't hardly remember to change my own underwear. My mind was never far from what Joe'd been up to with Selena, and the money he'd snuck out of the bank, and how was I going to get it back again? I understood I had to stop thinking about those things a while to find an answer. If I could, one might come on its own, but I couldn't seem to do it. Even when my mind did go somewheres else for a little bit, the least little thing would send it tumbling right back down that same old hole. I was stuck in one gear. It was driving me crazy. And I suppose that's the real reason I ended up speaking to Vera about what had happened. I surely didn't mean to speak to her. She'd been as sore-natured as a lioness with a thorn in her paw ever since she showed her face the May after her husband died. And I didn't have no interest in spilling my guts to a woman who acted like the whole world had turned to shit on her. But when I came in that day, her mood had finally changed for the better. She was in the kitchen, pinning an article she'd cut out of the front page of the Boston Globe to the cork bulletin board hung on the wall by the pantry door. She says, "Look at this, Dolores. If we're lucky and the weather cooperates, we're going to see something pretty amazing next summer." I still remember the headline of that article word for word after all these years, because when I read it, it felt like something turned over inside me. "Total eclipse to darken northern New England skies next summer," it said. There was a little map that showed what part of Maine would be in the path of the eclipse, and Vera'd made a little red pen mark along it where Little Tall was. "There won't be another one until late in the next century," she says. "Our grandchildren will see it, Dolores, but we'll be long gone, so we better appreciate this one." "It'll probably rain like a bugger that day," I says back, hardly even thinking about it. And with the dark temper Vera'd been in almost all the time since her husband died, I thought she'd snap at me. Instead, she just laughed and went upstairs, humming. I remember thinking that the weather in her head really had changed. Not only was she humming, she didn't have even a trace of a hangover. About 2 hours later, I was up in her room, changing the bed where she'd spend so much time laying helpless in later years. She was sitting in her chair by the window, knitting an Afghan square, and still humming. The furnace was on, but the heat hadn't really took yet. Those big houses take donkeys years to get warm, winterized or not. And she had her pink shawl thrown over her shoulders. The wind had come up strong from the west by then, and the rain hitting the window beside us sounded like handfuls of thrown sand. When I looked out that one, I could see the gleam of light coming from the garage that meant the hunky was up there in his little apartment, snug as a bug in a rug. I was tucking in the corners of the ground sheet. No fitted sheets for Vera Donovan, you can bet your bottom dollar on that. Fitted sheets would have been too easy. Not thinking about Joe or the kids at all for a change. And my lower lip started to tremble. "Quit that," I told myself. "Quit it right now." But that lip wouldn't quit. Then the upper one started to shimmy, too. All at once, my eyes filled up with tears and my legs went weak, and I sat down on the bed and cried. No. No. If I'm going to tell the truth, I might as well go whole hog. The fact is, I didn't just cry. I put my apron up over my face and wailed. I was tired and confused and at the end of my thinking. I hadn't had anything but scratch sleep in weeks and couldn't for the life of me see how I was going to go on. And the thought that kept coming into my head was, guess you were wrong, Dolores. Guess you were thinking about Joe and the kids after all. And of course I was. It had got so I wasn't able to think of nothing else, which was exactly why I was bawling. I don't know how long I cried like that, but I know when it finally stopped, I had snot all over my face and my nose was plugged up and I was so out of breath I felt like I'd run a race. I was afraid to take my apron down, too, because I had an idea that when I did, Vera would say, "That was quite a performance, Dolores. You can pick up your final pay envelope on Friday." Kenapensky, there, that was his name, Andy, I finally thought of it, "will give it to you." That would have been just like her. Except anything was just like her. You couldn't predict Vera even back in those days when she was in her right mind. When I finally took the apron off my face, she was sitting there by the window with her knitting in her lap, looking at me like I was some new and interesting kind of bug. I remember the crawly shadows the rain sliding down the window panes made on her cheeks and forehead. "Dolores," she said, "please tell me you haven't been careless enough to allow that mean-spirited creature you live with to knock you up again." For a second, I didn't have the slightest idea what she was talking about. When she said, "knock you up," my mind flashed to the night Joe had hit me with a stove length and I'd hit him with the creamer. Then it clicked, and I started to giggle. In a few seconds, I was laughing every bit as hard as I'd cried before, and not able to help that any more than I'd been able to help the other. I knew it was mostly horror. The idea of being pregnant again by Joe was about the worst thing I could think of, and the fact that we weren't doing the thing that makes babies anymore didn't change it. But knowing what was making me laugh didn't do a thing about stopping it. Vera looked at me a second or two longer, then picked her knitting up out of her lap and went back to it as calm as you please. She even started to hum again. It was like having the housekeeper sitting on her unmade bed, bellowing like a calf in the moonlight, was the most natural thing in the world to her. If so, the Donovans must have had some peculiar house help down there in Baltimore. After a while, the laughing went back to crying again, the way rain sometimes turns to snow for a little while during winter squalls if the wind shifts the right way. Then it finally wound down to nothing, and I just sat there on her bed, feeling tired and ashamed of myself, but cleaned out somehow, too. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Donovan," I says, "I truly am." "Vera," she says. "I beg pardon?" I asked her. "Vera," she repeated. "I insist that all women who have hysterics on my bed call me by my Christian name thenceforward." I don't know what came over me, I said. "Oh," she says right back, "I imagine you do. Clean yourself up, Dolores. You look like you dunked your face in a bowl of pureed spinach. You can use my bathroom." I went in to wash my face, and I stayed in there a long time. The truth was, I was a little afraid to come out. I'd quit thinking she was going to fire me when she told me to call her Vera instead of Mrs. Donovan. That ain't the way you behave to someone you mean to let go in 5 minutes. But I didn't know what she was going to do. She could be cruel. If you haven't got at least that much out of what I've been telling you, I've been wasting my time. She could poke you pretty much when and where she liked, and when she did it, she usually did it hard. "Did you drown in there, Dolores?" she calls in, and I knew I couldn't delay any longer. I turned off the water, dried my face, and went back into her bedroom. I started to apologize again right away, but she waved that off. She was still looking at me like I was a kind of bug she'd never seen before. "You know you startled the shit out of me, woman," she says. "All these years I wasn't sure you could cry. I thought maybe you were made of stone." I muttered something about how I hadn't been getting my rest lately. "I can see you haven't," she says. "You've got a matching set of Louis Vuitton under your eyes, and your hands have picked up a piquant little quiver." "I got what under my eyes?" I asked. Never mind, she says. Tell me what's wrong. A bun in the oven was the only cause of such an unexpected outburst I could think of. And I must confess, it's still the only thing I can think of, so enlighten me, Dolores. I can't, I says. And I'll be goddamned if my lower lip didn't start to tremble again. I could feel the whole thing getting ready to kick back on me again, like the crank of my dad's old Model A Ford used to do when you didn't grab it right. If I didn't watch out, pretty soon I was going to be sitting there on her bed again with my apron over my face. You can and you will, Vera said. You can't spend the day howling your head off. It'll give me a headache, and I'll have to take an aspirin. I hate taking aspirin. It irritates the lining of the stomach. I sat down on the edge of the bed and looked at her. I opened my mouth without the slightest idea of what was going to come out. What did was this. My husband is trying to screw his own daughter. And when I went to get their college money out of the bank so I could take her and the boys away, I found he'd scooped up the whole kit and caboodle. No, I ain't made out of stone. I ain't made out of stone at all. I started to cry again, and I cried for quite a while, but not so hard as before, and without feeling the need to hide my face behind my apron. When I was down to Sniffles, she said to tell her the whole story right from the beginning and without leaving a single thing out. And I did. I wouldn't have believed I could have told anyone that story, least of all Vera Donovan, with her money and her house in Baltimore and her pet hunky, who she didn't keep around just to polish her goddamn Lincoln. But I did tell her, and I could feel the weight on my heart getting lighter with every word. I spilled all of it, just like she told me to do. So I'm stuck, I finished. I just can't figure out what to do about this son of a bitch. I suppose I could catch on someplace if I just packed the kids up and took them to the mainland. I ain't never been afraid of hard work, but that ain't the point. What is the point, then, she asked me. The Afghan square she was working on was almost done. Her fingers were about the quickest I've ever seen. He's done everything but rape his own daughter, I says. He scared her so bad, she may never get all the way over it. And he's paid himself a reward of over $3,000 for his own bad behavior. I ain't gonna let him get away with it. That's the friggin' point. Is it? She says, in that mild voice of hers. And her needles went click, click, click. And the rain went rolling down the window panes, and the shadows wiggled and squiggled on her cheek and forehead like black veins. Looking at her that way made me think of a story my grandmother used to tell about the three sisters in the stars who knit our lives, one to spin and one to hold and one to cut off each thread whenever the fancy takes her. I think that last one's name was Atropos. Even if it's not, that name has always given me the shivers. Yes, I says to her, but I'll be goddamned if I see a way to do him the way he deserves to be done. Click, click, click. There was a cup of tea beside her, and she paused long enough to have a sip. There'd come a time when she'd like as not try to drink her tea through her right ear and give herself a Tetley shampoo. But on that fall day in 1962, she was still as sharp as my father's cutthroat razor. When she looked at me, her eyes seemed to bore a hole right through me to the other side. "What's the worst of it, Dolores?" she says finally, putting her cup down and picking up her knitting again. "What would you say is the worst? Not for Selina or the boys, but for you." I didn't even have to stop and think about it. That son of a whore's laughing at me, I says. That's the worst of it for me. I see it in his face sometimes. I never told him so, but he knows I checked at the bank. He knows damn well, and he knows what I found out. That could be just your imagination, she says. I don't give a frig if it is, I shot right back. It's how I feel. Yes, she says, it's how you feel that's important. I agree. Go on, Dolores. What do you mean, go on? I was going to say, that's all there is. But I guess it wasn't, because something else popped out, just like Jack out of his box. He wouldn't be laughing at me, I says, if he knew how close I've come to stopping his clock for good a couple of times. She just sat there looking at me, those dark, thin shadows chasing each other down her face and getting in her eyes so I couldn't read 'em. And I thought of the ladies who spin in the stars again, especially the one who holds the shears. I'm scared, I says, not of him, of myself. If I don't get the kids away from him soon, something bad is going to happen. I know it is. There's a thing inside me, and it's getting worse. Is it an eye? She asked calmly. And such a chill swept over me then. It was like she'd found a window in my skull and used it to peek right into my thoughts. Something like an eye? How'd you know that? I whispered. And as I sat there, my arms broke out in goosebumps and I started to shiver. I know, she says, and starts knitting a fresh row. I know all about it, Dolores. Well, I'm going to do him in if I don't watch out. That's what I'm afraid of. Then I can forget all about that money. I can forget all about everything. Nonsense, she says, and the needles went click, click, click in her lap. Husbands die every day, Dolores. Why, one is probably dying right now while we're sitting here talking. They die and leave their wives their money. She finished her row and looked up at me, but I still couldn't see what was in her eyes because of the shadows the rain made. They went creeping and crawling all across her face like snakes. I should know, shouldn't I? She says. After all, look what happened to mine. I couldn't say nothing. My tongue was stuck to the roof of my mouth like an inch bug to flypaper. An accident, she says, in a clear voice almost like a school teacher's, is sometimes an unhappy woman's best friend. What do you mean? I asked. It was only a whisper, but I was a little surprised to find I could even get that out. Why, whatever you think, she says. Then she grinned. Not a smile, but a grin. To tell you the truth, Andy, that grin chilled my blood. You just want to remember that what's yours is his and what's his is yours. If he had an accident, for instance, the money he's holding in his bank accounts would become yours. It's the law in this great country of ours. Her eyes fastened on mine, and for just a second, there, the shadows were gone, and I could see clear into them. What I saw made me look away fast. On the outside, Vera was just as cool as a baby sitting on a block of ice. But inside, the temperature looked to be quite a bit hotter. About as hot as it gets in the middle of a forest fire, I'd say at a guess. Too hot for the likes of me to look at for long, that's for sure. The law is a great thing, Dolores, she says. And when a bad man has a bad accident, that can sometimes be a great thing, too. Are you saying? I begun. I was able to get a little above a whisper by then, but not much. I'm not saying anything, she says. Back in those days when Vera decided she was done with a subject, she slammed it closed like a book. She stuck her knitting back in her basket and got up. I'll tell you this, though. That bed's never going to get made with you sitting on it. I'm going down and put on the tea kettle. Maybe when you get done here, you'd like to come down and try a slice of the apple pie I brought over from the mainland. If you're lucky, I might even add a scoop of vanilla ice cream. All right, I says. My mind was in a whirl. And the only thing I was completely sure of was that a piece of pie from the Jonesport Bakery sounded like just the thing. I was really hungry for the first time in over 4 weeks. Getting the business off my chest, done that much anyway. Vera got as far as the door and turned back to look at me. "I feel no pity for you, Dolores," she said. "You didn't tell me you were pregnant when you married him, and you didn't have to. Even a mathematical dunderhead like me can count back 9 months on the calendar and draw the right conclusions. What were you, 3 months gone?"
"Two," I said. My voice had sunk back to a whisper. "Selina come a little early."
She nodded. "And what does a conventional little island girl do when she finds the loaf's been leavened? The obvious, of course. But those who marry in haste often repent in leisure, as you seem to have discovered. Too bad your sainted mother didn't teach you that one, along with there's a heartbeat in every potato, and use your head to save your feet. But I'll tell you one thing, Dolores. Bawling your eyes out with your apron over your head won't save your daughter's maidenhead if that smelly old goat really means to take it, or your children's money if he really means to spend it. But sometimes men, especially drinking men, do have accidents. They fall downstairs, they slip in bathtubs, and sometimes their brakes fail and they run their BMWs into oak trees when they're hurrying home from their mistress's apartments in Arlington Heights. She went out then, closing the door behind her. I made up the bed, and while I did it, I thought about what she'd said. About how when a bad man has a bad accident, sometimes that can be a great thing, too. I began to see what had been right in front of me all along, what I would have seen sooner if my mind hadn't been flying around in a blind panic like a sparrow trapped in an attic room. By the time we'd had our pie and I'd seen her upstairs for her afternoon nap, the could-do part of it was clear in my mind. I wanted to be shut of Joe. I wanted the kid's money back, and most of all, I wanted to make him pay for all he'd put us through, especially for all he'd put Selina through. If the son of a bitch had an accident, the right kind of accident, all those things would happen. The money I couldn't get at while he was alive would come to me when he died. He might have snuck off to get the money in the first place, but he hadn't ever snuck off to make a will cutting me out. It wasn't a question of brains. The way he got the money showed me he was quite a bit slyer than I'd given him credit for, but just the way his mind worked. I'm pretty sure that down deep, Joe St. George didn't think he was ever going to die. And as his wife, everything would come right back to me. By the time I left Pinewood that afternoon, the rain had stopped, and I walked home real slow. I wasn't even halfway there before I'd started to think of the old well behind the woodshed. I had the house to myself when I got back. The boys were off playing, and Selina had left a note saying she'd gone over to Mrs. Devereaux's to help her do a laundry. She did all the sheets from the Harborside Hotel in those days, you know. I didn't have any idea where Joe was, and didn't care. The important thing was that his truck was gone, and with the muffler hanging by a thread the way it was, I'd have plenty of warning if he came back. I stood there a minute, looking at Selina's note. It's funny, the little things that finally push a person into making up her mind, sending her from could do to might do to will do, so to speak. Even now, I'm not sure if I really meant to kill Joe when I came home from Vera Donovan's that day. I meant to check on the well, yes, but that could have been no more than a game, the way kids play let's pretend. If Selina hadn't left that note, I might never have done it. And no matter what else comes of this, Andy, Selina must never know that. The note went something like this. "Mom, I have gone over to Mrs. Devereaux's with Cindy Babcock to help do the hotel wash. They had lots more people over the holiday weekend than they expected, and you know how bad Mrs. D's arthritis has gotten. The poor dear sounded at her wit's end when she called. I will be back to help with supper. Love and kisses, Sel." I knew Selina'd come back with no more than $5 or $7, but happy as a lark to have it.
She'd be happy to go back if Mrs. Devereaux or Cindy called her again, too. And if she got offered a job as a part-time chambermaid at the hotel next summer, she'd probably try to talk me into letting her take it. Because money is money. And on the island in those days, trading back and forth was still the most common way of life, and cash a hard commodity to come by. Mrs. Devereaux would call again, too, and be delighted to write a hotel reference for Selina if Selina asked her to, because Selina was a good little worker, not afraid to bend her back or get her hands dirty. She was just like me when I was her age, in other words, and look how I turned out. Just another cleaning witch with a permanent stoop in her walk and a bottle of pain pills in the medicine cabinet for my back. Selina didn't see nothing wrong with that, but she'd just turned 15. And at 15, a girl don't know what the hell she's seeing, even when she's looking spang at it. I read that note over and over, and I thought, frigate. She ain't gonna end up like me, old and damn near used up at 35. She ain't gonna do that even if I have to die to keep her from it. But you know something, Andy? I didn't think things would have to go that far. I thought maybe Joe was going to do all the dying that needed to be done around our place. I put her note back on the table, did up the snaps on my slicker again, and pulled on my gum rubber boots. Then I walked around back and stood by the big white stone where mean Selina sat the night I told her she didn't have to be afraid of Joe anymore, that he'd promised to let her alone. The rain had stopped, but I could still hear the water dripping deep in the blackberry tangle behind the house and see drops of water hanging off the bare branches. They looked like Vera Donovan's diamond drop earrings, only not so big. That patch covered better than half an acre, and by the time I'd pushed my way in, I was damn glad I had on my slicker and tall boots. The wet was the least of it. Those thorns were murder. In the late 40s, that patch had been flowers and field grass, with the wellhead sitting on the shed side of it. But about 6 years after me and Joe were married and moved onto the place, which his Uncle Freddie left him when he died, the well went dry. Joe got Peter Doyon to come over and douse us a new one on the west side of the house. We've never had a spot of water trouble since. Once we stopped using the old well, the half-acre behind the shed grew up in those chest-high snarls of scrub blackberry, and the thorns tore and pulled at my slicker as I walked back and forth looking for the board cap on the old well. After my hands got cut in three or four places, I pulled the sleeves down over them. In the end, I almost found the damn thing by falling into it. I took a step onto something that was both loose and kind of spongy. There was a crackling noise under my foot, and I drew back just before the board I'd stepped on gave way. If I'd been unlucky, I'd have fallen forward and the whole cap would most likely have collapsed. Ding-dong bell, pussies in the well. I got down on my knees, keeping one hand up in front of my face so the blackberry thorns wouldn't scratch my cheeks or maybe put out one of my eyes, and took a good close look. The cap was about 4 feet wide and 5 feet long. The boards were all white and warped and rotted. I pushed on one of them with my hand, and it was like pushing down on a licorice stick. The board I'd put my foot on was all bowed down, and I could see fresh splinters sticking up from it. I would have fallen in all right. And in those days, I went about 120. Joe weighed at least 50 pounds more than that. I had a handkerchief in my pocket. I tied it around the top of a bush on the shed side of the cap so I could find it again in a hurry. Then I went back into the house. That night I slept like a lamb, and I had no bad dreams for the first time since I'd found out from Selina what her Prince Charming of a dad had been up to with her.